Good evening. We had a very fine session with the help of a lot of hard work from many, many people. It was exactly the right size in my mind. 15 people was just about perfect. And it went very nicely. Had a little ceremony for Carolyn and Paula in the middle. And then David and Laura accepted the precepts and did marriage vows with each other. So it was an eventful week, even though it was very, very quiet. People really didn't talk very much at all. And suddenly it's over. It takes so much to go into it and make it happen, and then all of a sudden, whoosh, it's not there anymore. But already, there's talk about who's going to be the cook the next time. So we're going to have a shuso next time, and so life goes on, practice goes on. Isayo, how's your mouth?
It's good now.
We really missed you. I bet you did. Yeah. Those things just come up, but you just never know when it's going to happen. But you were very brave. Well, we're training our minds and cultivating loving kindness. Carrying on with this, and we've arrived at the Prajnaparamita part of it, which is the rest of it, basically. It's called point six. So he has a few paragraphs about the Prajnaparamita and the disciplines of mind training. He says that Prajna cuts what holds the ego. The attachment that creates the ego gets cut with prajna. And prajna is wisdom. So it's not smartness. It's not even intelligence, except in terms of maybe what's called emotional intelligence or an even deeper intelligence than that. It isn't about being smart, it's about being wise. And I think we can feel the difference. We can be absolutely right and smart and still be wrong. Be a smart aleck instead of a wise person. And it's important to know the difference. It has to do with how we speak, especially how we speak about others, and how we approach our life with kindness or with judgmental mind. So the basis of it, of course, is the ego, the bondage of ego, he calls it here. And he says it's connected with a larger sense of your entire life and especially with after meditation when you stand up. So from now on, this is about what we always are asking. Sitting is one thing, but then what do we do when we stand up? We're not sitting anymore, are we? Or maybe there is some kind of sitting going on as we comport ourselves in our ordinary life. So this is a whole set of slogans pointing out things that either we shouldn't do or we should, that help us to maintain a wholesome life and one that helps others, serves others, drops the sense of self. Compassion, kindness, openness, and gentleness, it says. No clinging, no working or dwelling on anything connected with ego. So number 23 is the first of these. And it's called Always Abide by the Three Basic Principles. And the principles are keeping the bodhisattva vows and the precept vows. The second one is refraining from outrageous action, is what Trungpa calls it, or exhibitionist spirituality is another way of thinking of it, of sort of being very spiritual and making a big deal about it and showing off as if that were spirituality. He says, basing our spiritual practice on our own self-snugness and self-delight seems to be one of the most dangerous things of all. I don't see that very much around here. I really don't see it around here at all. But I have seen it. In the many places where I go or have been going, it hits people sometimes as something to be is a spiritual person, to identify oneself. Oh, this is me. Oh, yes. I know my karma and know all the right words, but without a modest or even wise sense of what practice really is. And then the third one is developing patience, which is a very wise thing to advise. That you can make a sort of personality cult out of practice. So he says we have some kind of ground to walk on. We don't want to give up the ego. It gives us something to walk on. And we do not want to give up our most sacred and secret property, myself. That becomes problematic. We're not actually following the journey properly, he says. The Dharma should not be perverted on the basis of happiness, which in this case is any kind of confirmation existing within the Dharma, dharmic realm. In other words, getting patted on the back or patting someone on the back and saying, oh, my dear, you are such an angel. You are such a vastly spiritual person. Better to be invisible. Better to be... Coben always said he was a guerrilla warfare kind of person. You're sneaking around in the bushes so you don't have to go out be somebody in this thing. You can make a cult of yourself, a personality cult. Through prajna, you realize how much you're trying to become something, to turn yourself into something. Anything sometimes we feel. There's a sort of insecurity that drives us to think of ourselves as the one who holds a particular job. Oh, I'm a manager now, or almost anything that you can identify yourself as, and then hold that identification sometimes people for a whole life until they lose their job or they have to move and suddenly everything changes, or their children pass away and they're not parents anymore, the things that are so radical that suddenly the misunderstanding about oneself becomes so obvious that there is no longer any ground, which is the truth of it. Anything can stop and change at any moment into something else. So it doesn't mean we can't be somebody because we have to be somebody, but if we hold on to it too tightly and resist when it changes, then we get in trouble. So the point is not to cling to the self. It isn't not to be yourself, it's just not to cling to it. Because there isn't any real self that's permanent. What we have as a self is something that's always changing. So we pat ourselves on the back and take good care of ourselves and try our best to practice with kindness. Very simple, really. But it takes a lot of effort and patience. So I think that's what you get to take home with you, is these three points. The Bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. So if we kept just those four, we'd be in good shape. And the precepts. The constant precepts. David and Laura, for the wedding, rewrote the precepts a little bit, which a lot of brides and grooms do, which is really fine practice, because then you have to sit down and agree together with all 10 of them. 10 different ways of expressing these simple things: not to kill, not to steal, not to lie. What do we say together about these? how do we understand, how do I understand your understanding, and how do you understand mine, and do we agree, and how do we agree? So it's great. I always insist that they take that on way early. If a wedding is being planned, well, that's what you do as you work on the precepts. So that's the first one. And the second one is refraining from exhibitionist spirituality. And the third one is being patient and not creating a cult of oneself. So see how that comes out. And what we had before was about direct awareness and practicing even when distracted. So, looking at my notes here. So Wallace says, when adversity becomes an ally in the fulfillment of our deepest aims, the cultivation of wisdom and compassion, it is no longer adversity. When adversity is no longer experienced as adversity, this is a sign of success in practice. So it's up to us how we perceive our difficulties. If we label them as difficult, then they're difficult. But if we experience them as, in one place it says, experience adversity as the kayas, as the bodies of Buddha. That whatever hardship, whatever confusion, whatever misery even, it's all an expression of Buddha. So it's been 2 weeks, and I don't know what we've all been doing during those 2 weeks, but maybe we can talk about this adversity business a little bit, how we can be with it when it happens, how we have been with it as it happens.
Working with this for several years, and finally she was able to move her to somewhere safe and close to her sister so we could pass off a little bit of the care. But during all this time when we're doing these final things, like moving and getting the folks up there, we learned that there was an x-ray that showed something unusual, and we had this period of time of not knowing what it could be. Mm-hmm. and it was either going to be one thing or something much more serious. Mm-hmm. this is kind of funny in the context of not being pump up yourself about being so spiritual, but I have been in contact with Rose, for example, and often the way I relate with her, Rose, she reflects when, I can't explain this quite right, but she reflected to me that during this time, I was staying very present with it and not turning away, she said. And not creating an imaginative result, but just being present. Like right now, we don't know what it is. And I noticed there was a sweet quality of realizing what it could be, or sort of it brought us more into the present. Staying more present with our immortality and our weakness as humans, but also not creating imagination about what we don't know it is anyway. So I guess this was a time where I had feedback from someone I respect as, boy, I stayed present with that. That feels good. So I guess that
feedback helps.
It helps
a lot, and she's good at that.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, that is adversity. Did it turn out?
Turned out okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm glad to hear.
Big relief.
Yeah. Ah. So you're getting settled a bit.
Finally. Yes.
Yay. Yeah. Oh, thank you, Karen.
Yeah.
How do we talk about this without being smug?
It's tricky. There was a long time when I didn't talk about it at all. I didn't tell anybody what I was doing. It was early on in our culture, for one thing, and people did think it was a cult. My husband thought it was a cult, and he was alarmed that I was meeting with this little group in Los Altos. So I kept it a secret from the neighbors and my kids' friends, and you know. But eventually, my friends wanted to know what I was doing because they saw that I was doing something, and they were curious. And then I could talk about it a little bit. But proselytizing is such a bad idea. Trying to lay it on people as this thing that they, you know, they've got to try because it's so great. I think it mostly puts people off unless it's very skillfully done. And my notion about it is that our presence by itself is usually enough, that we don't have to put on airs or talk about our practice so much as just to be with people in the way the Bodhisattva vow is saying. Just to be there, because how we are is very deeply affected by our practice. Practice is loving kindness, and so even though we don't necessarily think of ourselves as lovingly kind all the time, still it happens. We don't have a choice in a way. It comes through the practice itself, if it's a sincere practice. I think because we work through our adversities and difficulties and the lies that we tell ourselves, and we get to be more honest, and being more honest is just an atmosphere that we bring with ourselves wherever we go. But sometimes people are curious. And then mostly I say, you know, it's like swimming, you have to get in the water. It's hard to talk about if you haven't been in the water or even seen it. It doesn't help to talk about it or read books about it. the best way is just to get in and maybe hold on to the edge for a while until you get used to it, but sit. Just do the practice. What do you do?
What do I do?
Uh-huh.
I usually don't say anything.
You don't say anything. Yeah. Yeah, that's probably mostly the best way. Yeah.
People ask me about it, I always take the attitude that there's explained that there's many different ways, all kinds of standards in this area, you can see all kinds of traditions.
Yes.
And just kind of explain that fact, and then just again, like you said, just say you have to kind of figure out for yourself what the path is.
Mm-hmm.
And don't expect that I'll come to your city group or even go at all.
Yeah. That's the truth of it. There are trillions of opportunities around here. It's just amazing.
I had a humorous experience with that. Many years ago, I was practicing with a different group. And the person at work came to me and said, I hear you're practicing. I've got to meet your teacher. I've just got to meet your teacher. I've been wanting to do this for years. So I set it up, brought him up. We sat a period, met the teacher. And he came over afterwards and said, thank you so much. Now I know exactly this is not what I wanted. I said, good. Now you know.
That's funny.
Yeah. That is data.
Well, that's the way. And it does rather work that way.
For me, it was the other way. I said, wow, this is great.
Yeah, that's what happened to me. Yeah, I walked in the Zendo and I thought, my goose is cooked.
This
is it.
Just like home.
Yeah, just like home. Exactly. Well, I have a thing to share with you that came over the internet that has come through for the last couple of years called the Walk to Feed the Hungry. Have you all heard about that? It happens in all over the country. One of the places it's happening is San Jose. And it's the invention of Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is very famous in Vipassana circles. And they walk about 5 miles, I think, through downtown San Jose. And usually they start from here, either start here or end here. And they don't give any more information than that, except that the date is October 19th. But they said there would be more information on the website, and I haven't had a chance to look at that, but I'm sure there'll be more information there. But I thought that's something that I wish I could walk 5 miles. I that's out of my ability anymore, but it's a very popular thing to do. Ritu used to do it every year. So I'll leave this information here. If you all are interested, you can come and pick it up. So, are there any announcements?
No.
We're all done.
Yeah, the big event for the month was the she, and that's done.
That's it. Gosh. So the next sit on Saturday will happen next month. Is that right?
Right.
Okay.
September.
Okay.
I can't remember. It's a half day.
Yeah. Okay.
I haven't announced nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The book club, which sort of took a hiatus, would like to get started in the month of September. We could finish up what we have been working on and start thinking about a new book.
Mm-hmm. Good.
So look at September.
Okay.
You'll set the date later on.
With, and I'd love to get as much feedback from everybody who'd be interested in the book club. In terms of primarily the date,
mm-hmm.
the day that you'd like to meet. So we meet once a month.
Could you tell people what book we're studying?
We are on chapter 5, I believe, now. Opening the Hand of Thought. And we began that book, it seems like about a year ago. So. And it's been it's just been a very valuable book for us to set.
Yes, mention the book title. Sorry.
And Samia, you didn't have any adversity on your last few weeks?
That's funny you ask, because I was thinking of saying something, and I said, well, how do I say it without sounding like...
Well, we already know.
I kind of got a little bit of it, but since you asked so directly, I will say something. We were in Europe for 2 weeks, my family, husband and daughter, and last year we had an incredible time with our daughter, and she was like perfect, very cordial. So I was looking forward for this year, thinking it's going to be the same, and it was not the same at all.
Oh.
She was being a smart, whatever you call it.
Yes.
And we were both shocked about it, but, you know, I kind of know her sweet side, too, but she kept on coming back and doing those things. And of course, as parents, you want to tell them that's not the best way.
Yeah.
And you feel responsible for doing that. And I kept doing it every time. And at one point, I express something to my husband that at the beginning that it shouldn't be that difficult, you know, if you approach it with kindness and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So you know the smart way. So, okay, I can do this. Next tomorrow she does it. You know, it's kindness and all of that. But at some point you lose patience. You know, how many times do you do it?
Yeah.
And at one point we're explaining how spending too much money is not the way for happiness. And one thing after the other, and she looked at me, and she goes, yeah, Mom, yeah, you're right. You know it all, don't you? But she said it in a way that hit me, like,
yeah.
I probably do sound that way. She's 16, I'm 53.
Yeah.
You know, and it just hit me and really shot me up.
Mm.
Like, at some point, I gotta quit telling
yes.
her how much I know.
Yes.
And wanting her to be perfect.
Well, that was your job for a long time, and you're getting to the point where you have to give it up.
Right.
Even though she's probably not ready yet. She thinks she is.
And then I told her, I said, Maya, I am not gonna talk. Say anything anymore.
Yeah.
And she goes, "You're just saying that. I know you. You start talking to me." So you're walking in this cute little town, and she's behind me, like, "When are you going to start talking to me?" It was very difficult.
Oh.
But sweet in the same way.
Yeah.
Like, just testing.
And you really did it specially for her, the trip.
I wanted to go to Japan, and she didn't want to go there. I said, okay, I'll go wherever you want to go. Thank you for listening.
Oh, yeah.
Can I ask one quick question?
Mm-hmm.
Had her baby?
Yes.
Oh. Good, yeah, it's okay.
Did she contact anybody?
Uh-uh.
Oh, okay, so I'll say something. I was in Italy looking at clothes, small clothes. I sent her a picture of a little sweater I got her, and then I didn't think I'd hear from her. I said, you know, I don't know what's going on. She sent an email, and she said she had the baby. I can't remember the date now. 28th, 29th. Is that right? Something like that. And she goes, "I never thought I could experience pain like that." And she was thinking of not having an epidural.
Yes.
And I kind of warned her about that.
Yes.
And she goes, "Thank God for drugs, for drugs and doctors." And she sent a picture of the baby and that they're doing well.
Good.
And I told her at one point when things settle down and she can sleep that we can have another little get together and we can meet her baby.
Yes.
Them, all of them.
Yes. That would be lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, thank you, Samia.
I'll send the email and the picture.
Great.
I'll send it to Wendy and maybe Wendy can.
Well, I'm glad to hear that she had a vaginal birth.
Well, I don't know. She didn't go through the details of what happened. She didn't say what
it sounds like. It.
Right, yeah. Or else that, there you go.
Yeah.
I guess you don't experience pain.
During instead of
after. Well, you could have labor and still experience pain and then go into a C-section. So.
That's true.
It doesn't really hurt until the end.
I don't know.
Well, you don't know.
Yeah, it hurts a lot at the end. But I was surprised. I said, "I'm shocked you even wrote an email."
Yeah, I almost emailed you to ask you because I knew she would contact you.
Well, she didn't. I sent her an email of the sweater. Just told her I was thinking of you.
Glad you did that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
One minute. So.